Park Place Meeting, Saturday afternoon, 24th of May, 1975. Let me start with this quotation from St. Teresa, which you must have read, in the letter which was in your room when you arrived. I do not ask you to make curious considerations in your mind. Curious considerations. I only ask you to look. Saint Teresa was one of the very, very remarkable figures in history. One of the great saints of the Catholic world. This is Saint Teresa of Avila. There was the other Saint Teresa of Lisieux too. This is Saint Teresa of Avila. Her works are remarkable works. And if you study any one of them, particularly works like The Interior Castle, and if you yourself have been through strenuous religious discipline, in the grand sense of the term discipline, and reached anywhere near the end of the road, you will realize that St. Teresa was certainly one who had realized the supreme things that can be realized by man on earth. I myself often look into her book, The Interior Castle. It's a remarkable work. It is as remarkable for me in its own way and in its own form of expression as Ruysbroeck's The Sparkling Stone, which is a very condensed little work, is. And also, of course, his great The Adornment of the Spiritual Marriage. I'll repeat that again. I do not ask you to make curious considerations in your mind. I only ask you to look. Now, yesterday afternoon, we asked ourselves the question, do we who meet here, meet in fellowship and in love, do we really know each other? And you may remember that we tried out an experiment of actually looking at each other and making certain notes in that connection, and then considering those notes in relation to our own selves. And one of the important points which we brought out, or tried to bring out, was that if there is real purity in our own being, if there is real love, and if there is freedom, therefore, from this self-centered ego consciousness, we can really look. Now, this was the first time that we attempted such a thing in a large group like this. And from some of the remarks which I heard afterwards from members, it was clear that our first attempt at looking belonged really to the kindergarten stage, which is perfectly natural, perfectly right. The starting point in any learning process is a kindergarten stage. What was seen, that is to say, as far as the written words were concerned by the members, what was seen was the appearance of the other person. Not only the physical appearance, but the impression one received of that person's characteristics. In some cases, it was not possible to miss those characteristics because we know each other. We have met each other quite a lot. And therefore, we have certain impressions in our mind. But consider this carefully. Is a person's character the fundamental, ultimate reality of that person? When we look at a living organism belonging to the human species, what are we looking at? We say we are looking at a person. What is the meaning of that word person? That word comes from the Sanskrit Purusha. And if you look into the exposition in the old religious texts of the meaning of the word Purusha in the supremely religious context as such, you will find it expanded that it means one in whom all evil-mindedness, all ill, is burnt out. The utterly purified Holy One. The pur part means formally. It refers to purva, which means formally. The ush. Ush is the root Sanskrit word which means to burn out. And then the text goes on to explain it in this fashion. Because formerly he, the Holy One, burnt out all evil-mindedness, therefore he is termed the Purusha. And it is from that that our word person comes. That is the person. But what sort of a being is one who has burnt out all evil within him, who is the perfected Holy One? Do I know such a person? Does any one of us know such a person? Yes, we would say we have the examples of the great founders of the religions, and many others who were holy ones throughout the centuries. There have been instances. But do we know that because we ourselves see that as a fact? Or because we have been so conditioned to believe that such and such a person was a holy one? Just as we know that so and so is a doctor of philosophy or a master of arts or whatever it is, because he has a certificate. Has the perfected Holy One a certificate? Or is the perfected Holy One more comparable to a gem of the first water, of the most wonderful luster? But if I am not an expert jeweler, how shall I evaluate the gem? Could I distinguish the Kohinoor in the crown of the queen from a very skillfully made crystal from some other substance. Unless I were myself a skilled jeweler, a master myself, therefore, when I look, I will know, yes, this is the perfect gem, that is a counterfeit, or that is not such a wonderful gem as this one. I would know by my own power of sight. Now, have we as human beings developed that insight within us which would enable us to recognize, really to recognize, the perfected Holy One when we meet Him? You see? How often do we hear, oh, if I had been living in the days of the Buddha, or if I had been living at the time when Jesus taught, or Krishna flourished, or Zarathustra taught in Iran, and so forth, I would not have done such and such evil things. I would have been a faithful disciple or something like that. Would I? Have I the intelligence now to recognize? Have I the purity within my own being which will enable me to see the pure one and know straight away that is a pure one? You see, these questions arise. And our word person, which in origin has this exalted meaning, has come to be applied to anyone and everyone in the world. They are all persons. See, here is a case where the concept of person is has such a blinding influence upon the immediate living percept of the person. The immediate living percept is the important thing. But because we have a concept that a person is, oh, a two-legged, tailless creature called a human being, and so on and so on. So the moment we see this two-legged, tailless being, we say, oh, that's a person there, and dismiss the person. We don't look. And we haven't even got the capacity to look and see the person. Now there is a dual implication in this word and in connection with our act of looking at a human being. We start off from where we are. I, the imperfect one, incapable of evaluating fully, of seeing absolutely truly. We'll start off from there. So I see the external shape, the external form of that person, of any human being. Now the average human being is not a person in that exalted ultimate meaning of the word person, the perfected Holy One. We all know that. So we see only the outward form, the clothes that the person within wears. Even his living body, his character, his psyche, his mental and moral qualities and abilities, and his disabilities and faults and so forth, they are all the external clothes that is worn by something within which is divine, which is this, which is divinity in potentiality. Transcendence is embodied in us. We use phrases like, a spark of the divine is enshrined in every mortal body. In the teachings of yoga, it is said that Shiva, the third person of the Trinity, resides within the supreme aspect of man, symbolized by the brain. The brain is only a symbol. Intelligence, pure intelligence. And in so many different ways, the different religions indicate quite clearly that transcendence is embodied within each and every one of us. So now, when I look at a person and I see the outward shape and form, the characteristics of the person, the way he behaves, and the impression that he creates, the way he acts and so on, I am just looking at that which is external, that which belongs to time and circumstance, that which continuously changes, because no person remains the same throughout his life. He continuously changes, and all those characteristics and impressions pass away and give place to something else, a mirage. But that transcendent reality embodied there is what I am unable to see. That is what I fail to see. We will ask, well, what will make me see that? Nothing will make me see that. If I have the right sort of humility, which means that there is one thing which I do certainly know, namely that I do not know. That I have constantly to be the learner, constantly seeing, constantly letting my eyes be opened. And they are opened because I do not obstruct their being opened by something which is infinitely greater than myself. It is the totality, it is the one total reality, it is transcendence which looks through my eyes, actually. But I am unaware of that. I am ignorant of that. So, there is nothing which will make me see. If I cease to obstruct, if I care for that real thing, if I give myself completely in love, because I cannot help giving myself to that totality, the penny to Caesar, your whole being to God, that's the idea. If I do that, then from within myself, and that is to say, myself having the potentiality of divinity inside is open, the immanent God, to use a theistic phrase, is free to make communion with the transcendent, and the two together effect the purification. My eyes open, the blind see, the lame, the deaf hear, and the lame walk. These are miracles which are ascribed to all the great founders of the religions. Study them and you will find that they are all credited with miracles of that sort. And the first open statement of this comes in the Atharva Veda of the Hindus. I mentioned something which was very ancient with the Hindus this morning also, but it is very ancient simply because they happen to be more or less the grandfathers of the Indo-European race. That's why. In the Atharva Veda, which is not closer to our times than 1000 BC, in one of the hymns you will find it said that the blind sees, the deaf hears, the cripple walks, and so forth. When you give yourself to that transcendent reality, not because you are driven by personal desire to see transcendence, personal desire to hear the word of God, personal desire to be the holy man, as long as there is mere personal desire, if the I consciousness, I want to be the perfected Holy One, is there, that will completely defeat your ends. You never will be there. When this separate I has completely cast off all its veils, then it is free from all its inner illusions. It is clean and pure. And then that transcendent reality takes you into itself. Then your eyes are open. And when you look at a person, you'll know this is the Holy One. So now, this little exercise we started yesterday. I started it with this kind of thing in mind. Let us look at just one other point in connection with it. When we note down the impressions we get of another person who is near us and at whom we are looking, when we note down those impressions, what we note down is a mental picture which has been formed. Stimuli, impressions come from outside, through the senses, reach the brain. Then, because of our faculty of speech, which synthesizes all our sense impressions, in order to make limited concepts by which we can carry on our ordinary everyday business in the world, those impressions are spoken of or written down by a conditioned mind. That means the mind which is limited. So you see, the impressions that I, as an ordinary human being, get of another person are always wrong. They are never completely right. They never can be completely right. You know that marvelous story in the New Testament where the woman is brought unto Jesus and she's caught in adultery, and the Jewish custom was to stone the adulterer to death. And Jesus says, let him that is without sin throw the first stone. Nobody throws. And then Jesus says an extraordinary thing. Neither do I condemn thee. What is there to condemn? The perfected Holy One sees divinity imprisoned, tortured by that outward shape and form. He sees that divinity and he sends her away. And then again, there is that case where he says, you have five husbands. How does one say that of a person whom he hasn't met? He didn't have any private access to any private dossier. But he just knew. What is the meaning of this kind of knowing? The heart, which is all love, love in its transcendence, mind you, the mind, which is all wisdom, just knows. It just knows. It's the kind of knowledge which is not acquired, which it cannot be acquired. It is there within ourselves. And one of the great purposes of our human evolution, not evolution merely in the restricted sense in which the scientist uses the word, but of our full human development, one of the great purposes is that these dormant divine potentialities within mankind will slowly emerge and come to fruition. then we know each other. Now, one last point in this connection of looking at a person and knowing him. When you know the person, there is the state of communion there with that person. And it is not a state of communion which is made just now, but it is awakening to the fact that the reality of communion is permanently, is a permanent foundation of our very existence. What holds the universe together? Today, modern science itself is coming to it, to that sort of view. It is this extraordinary relationship between all things, complete and perfect relationship which underlies the entire universal process, and one awakes to that. So now, when we look, if we can look at a person without looking for something, if our own minds become emptied of all their limitations, then the act of looking is a chord of communion, and you just know the person. What happens then? There is no discord. There is no wrongdoing. There is no separation. That person ceases to be another person, an other. The otherness has vanished, completely vanished. Because what you hold perpetually in your own consciousness is you yourself. Put it the other way around if you like. I am that person. That person is me. This we can awaken to in mind and consciousness. If the mind is purified, if consciousness is truly awake to truth, to ultimate reality, then there is no discord. Then you see the person and you discover the marvelous fact that that person is also this person. You see now why in the Trismegistic writings, the Hellenized form of Greek, of Egyptian teaching, it has been put that God, who is all Father mind, created man in his own image, with whom he fell in love, because what he created was so like his sire, God himself. Man in the image of God, the archetypal divine conception, which is represented also in the word logos originally. The word logos, the word, is this archetypal conception. And of course, in Genesis, in the very first chapter, Elohim said, it's usually translated as God said, let us make man in our own image. In our own image. But Elohim, which represents the transcendent divine power, being, energy, call it what you like, Elohim in process of manifestation and creation is God in that sense. Yahweh is God in the sense of the divine potentiality which is hidden within each living person. That's Yahweh. When you get the two together, Elohim Yahweh, usually it is put as Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God as it is translated, then the immanence and the transcendence are treated as a unity. Our difficulty is that all these different Hebrew terms are translated by the one word God, and it doesn't therefore give us clues to clarify the different aspects. Elohim, God as the divine process of creation, made man in his own image. Now, the living, because God is the perpetual living, creates man. That which is created by the living is living. The word image really stands for in his own likeness. It doesn't mean something static, something which is without life. And the life here is the divine life. It is important for us really to meditate very deeply on these things. Enter into them with all your heart and your soul, but enter without desire. We stand in the divine presence by the grace of the divine. We are never thrown out of the cosmos, are we? We are always, in other words, in the divine presence by virtue of the grace of that divine power. So enter into this with all your heart and your soul, in deep meditation, letting the mind and the heart be quiet. All the upsurge of desire, of ambition, of fear, of possessiveness, of violence, and all the rest of it, let that just be at peace. If you let it be at peace and can enter into this state, you will find that the fact that you are in that state experiencing this transcendent reality, even for a single instant, what we call the evil qualities in us are transformed. They are burnt. But the burning is a process not of destroying, of consuming. It is a process of transmutation. And we are fortunate to live in this age, in this century, where transmutation has a very real meaning. In the old days, all they knew of was transformation. But we have gone just one step further, and we have begun to understand this mysterious, marvelous thing, transmutation. And where there is transmutation, there is no loss. There is only the release into more and more wonderful perfection. So our ill qualities, which are our psychic energy, distorted, locked up into disharmonious patterns, is liberated, and in the liberating become virtues. In other words, if you like to use another symbolism, the demons of hell within us are transformed into the angels of heaven. And you will appreciate then this extraordinary psychological fact of our being, that if we have some evil in us, some vice in us, the greater its strength, the more marvelous is the potentiality of the angelic quality, if we can let it get transformed. But I have to let it get transformed. This is where I, as the individual person, come in. Choice rests with the individual. Will he allow the transcendent to work, or will he obstruct transcendence? This sort of teaching comes out beautifully in the Zarathustrian teachings in Iran, where the mind is presented as dual. The mind is either the Akhem Mano, the ill mind, or the Spento Mainyu, the good mind. And both elements are simultaneously present in us. We have the power of choice. Which shall we nurture, cultivate? And in nurturing and cultivating the good mind, the so-called evil mind is transformed into the good mind. That is to say, the evil aspect of the mind is transformed into complete and perfect good. Now, so we see all that emerges out of this simple little exercise which we started yesterday, to look at each other. To look not with the eyes of possessiveness, eyes aflame with passion, eyes which send out a destructive hate, anger, disapproval. But the eyes which are utterly pure and clean, windows of the soul, by which the deepmost elements of our intelligence can look through and recognize divinity embodied in anybody and everybody. Now you see, there can be no alternative to loving your neighbor. To love your neighbor as your own self. But which self? Not this outward garb, this outward garment, which is the shape and structure of the body, my characteristics and qualities and so forth, but this innermost divinity which lies within me. And the innermost divinity that lies within me is the one divinity that exists everywhere throughout the universe. We talk of the omnipresence of God, but do we live as if God were here? But that is the truth. The transcendent is here. The ultimate reality is this here. not somewhere else. That is to say, what we call somewhere else is simultaneously the eternal here, the here now. So you see, we don't have to develop some marvelous technique, so to say, to love our neighbor. Because if my imperfect intellect, if my heart, which is not wholly clean, were to devise ways of loving my neighbor, all my taints, my illnesses will exist and will influence the way I have devised for myself. Why did Sri Krishna, just as Jesus did centuries later, say, "I am the way, I am the path, I am the life, the truth"? Who is this I am? It is the one and only I am that is. I who am. Ehiye asher ehiye, as written in Exodus when Moses hears the voice of the transcendent speak out of the burning bush. In Zarathustrian teaching, you have the Lord answering Zarathustra, saying, "My first name is Ahammi, I who am, the eternal am, the one and only I am." But you see, we have to beware of veiling the ultimate reality with all our particular conceptions and thoughts and beliefs and ideas and convictions about these things. Because beliefs, thoughts, convictions and so forth are the product of our imperfect minds. When the word is spoken, supposing someone, a perfected holy one, were here and spoke the word of truth itself. What happens when he speaks the word? I interpret it, don't I? I interpret it. And how does the act of interpretation, the process of interpretation, take place? Through the mechanism of my own imperfect mind, with all its flaws and faults, as well as its abilities. And therefore, my interpretation falls short, is inadequate, is in fact often and often misleading with respect to the truth, to the reality. It is very important, therefore, to realize this intensely. The one thing I can know is that I do not know. I must not presume. It is not I who can teach or save or anything like that. It is transcendence itself which does it all. So, if we can set aside the limitations imposed upon us by the particular beliefs and convictions we hold, and keep a completely open-minded, completely open mind, and give the heart in purity to the reality, then that truth, that reality, will continuously be opening up our consciousness, our innermost awareness to the truth, the transcendent reality. You see now how different the context of religion is from the context of art, science, philosophy, and all practical techniques and so forth. All these others lie within the sphere of mortality, within the sphere of limitation, within the sphere where you are liable to delusions and illusions, as the Buddha said. But within us, because there is this transcendent reality embodied, waiting until I cease to obstruct it, then something else comes into fruition within one's own mind. The miracle of transmutation of the ill mind takes place. And then one knows truth, not by imprisoning truth within particular concepts and a system of words, but by actually being the truth. I am the truth, the way, the life, as the great teachers said. What does that mean? I am the truth. The Buddha said, he who beholds me beholds the embodied truth. He who sees the truth sees me. You see, something like this has to absolutely fill us like a burning light. A burning which doesn't destroy, which doesn't hurt, but which heals, makes whole, makes complete, makes holy, sanctifies. And it can happen in our very body. Then the terms, the Lord is in his holy temple, is a realized fact in the world of men. This is why the millions of devotees of the great religions regard their teacher as God incarnate. Sri Krishna was called Bhagavan, God. Jesus was God incarnate in Jesus. His name in Hebrew, Yahshuah, Yod, He, Shein, Vav, He, Yahshuah. Note carefully, there is the Shein, the letter Shein, in between Yod He on this side and Vav He on the other side. Now you take out the Shein, you get Yahweh. The conceptual, the transcendent divinity, not enfleshed yet. It is the Shein which represents this extraordinary marvel of the enfleshment of divinity. So that the ultimate manifestation of divinity takes place in the living being himself. And this is a teaching common to the great religions. So let this be a burning flame, a light unto yourselves. And a light which radiates love and wisdom and healing to all around. And we start simply by using our senses. Look. Don't look for transcendence there, because I have said these things. Don't believe what I said. Don't reject it out of hand. Consider it. Bearing in mind St. Teresa's words, I do not ask you to make curious considerations in your mind. I only ask you to look, which means to look free from the limitations imposed by our conditioning, by our concepts, our beliefs, our ideas, our fixations, our psychological illnesses, which blind our spiritual eyes, the third eye, as it is called in India. Just look. Allow the looking to take place. Listen in that way. Allow the listening to take place. Watch the light, the hidden light. With our ordinary fleshly eyes, we cannot see what is hidden. But for the eyes of the soul, there is nothing that is hidden. If the eyes of the soul are allowed to see. So you will appreciate how and why the whole of the religious life starts with striving to live the holy life, the brahmacharya, the godly path, as it is called. Brahmacharya is the walking. We start in the beginning and, of course, stumble. But we are children where the living of the holy life is concerned. So we must stumble. I have never come across a child, have you, which stood upon its feet and immediately walked perfectly like an adult? No. All children will of necessity stumble. But how merciful and gracious nature is. It has made the child so elastic that if a person like me had some of the falls that a child has, I'd probably break some bones or even die. But not the child. In the same way, in our spiritual nature, so gracious, so marvelous, is the beneficence of transcendence that we bounce up again from our fall. Because there is this love longing, this urge to the divine life, which makes us spring up again. And that is how it happens. And that is how it goes on. There is nothing so wonderful, nothing so truly productive of happiness, this calm, inward, peaceful happiness, than the religious life. It is the human life par excellence. So, look, listen, let this flame burn inside and grow into the fulfillment of your own divine destiny.